You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I think especially in light of the advent of Antifa, you have some pretty bad dudes on the other side also, and essentially that's what I said.
Donald Trump says he did say the thing he previously said he hadn't said. At the end of another week for which John Kelly has not been paid enough, my guests Henry Rhys Sheridan, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Daniel Giacopelli will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the possibility that North Korea's missile launches are getting kind of tedious, whether or not it is wrong to wish that freedom of speech activists would put a sock in it, and have we run out of things we actually need apps for? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Welcome all. We will start with North Korea, whose terrorizing of the marine creatures of the northern Pacific Ocean continues unabated, with another missile test over Japanese territory. Japan, which didn't find this funny the first time, led the protests, while South Korea responded with a missile test of its own. Elsewhere, the usual consequences of such shenanigans ensued. A meeting of the UN Security Council and the US and China and Russia squabbling amongst themselves. Danny, first of all, this thought occurred to me the last time they did this, which was the other week, I guess. What would happen if after a provocation such as this from North Korea, the world just sort of shrugged and went, man, whatever?
Very good question. Are you asking me to speak on behalf of all 350 million Americans, as you normally do?
If you would, yes.
Well, I don't know. What would happen if people said whatever after Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia?
This isn't that, though.
Well, no, but it could be. I mean, I just think, yeah, you could ignore him, but then he might throw more tantrums.
I think one thing that might be interesting that could be revealed if everyone really did say whatever is that we might pull the dust sheet off another interesting aspect of what's motivating the North Korean regime. Because at the moment, it's quite difficult to tell what they're after, partly because people are reacting in such a kind of stock, rational way to what they're doing. And you can't help but get the feeling that people are probably reacting in a way that they want them to react. If the North Koreans are genuinely concerned with what they see as an imperialist crusade against them, then if other countries flagged no intention to continue that crusade, how would they continue to justify what they're doing? They'd probably find a way, but they might have to change their tack a little bit.
But nobody is threatening them. I mean, no one actually really cares about North Korea. It's just that North Korea keeps doing things which may conceivably one day be an external threat that anybody takes an interest at all.
No, but rhetorically, they're very good at spinning completely normal behaviour on the part of other states as fundamental threats to their regime.
True enough.
So I think, again, coming back to the whatever hypothesis, If that did happen,
is that Henry Rhys Sheridan's international relations doctrine?
They may find it. What I'm trying to say, they may
it's
find
my
it more
doctrine,
difficult
Danny.
To do
it's,
that.
It's going to be the title.
The
of, it's going to be the title of my best-selling book, The Whatever Hypothesis.
Henry Kissinger, whatever.
Yeah, it's going to be the title of a best-selling book on foreign affairs or an unlistenable jazz band, yeah. Like there's any other kind. Fernando, it's not just politics, though, is there? If you make a career on outrage and provocation, you kind of get trapped, don't you? You have to keep finding ways to expand on it. Has North Korea reached that point? Is North Korea now basically Marilyn Manson?
Well, I think so in some ways. And it's interesting because I was listening. Well, actually, I do like a bit Marilyn Manson, but never mind. We heard before, one of our shows, The Briefing, our correspondent in Seoul, saying, you know, people are getting tired. I think especially in South Korea and Japan, people are not even that worried about North Korea, perhaps because they're so used to those daily threats. You know, but as Dennis said, we can't just ignore it, you know, and he gave a good example there with Hitler invading Czechoslovakia. Of course we shouldn't ignore it, but then again, what to do? Because it's such a volatile country, so you don't want to be too saying we're going to bomb you, because you know they, you know, he clearly is an unstable leader. You know,
it's not quite the same as Hitler invading Czechoslovakia though, right? Because you can only invade Czechoslovakia once, whereas you can launch test missiles that can be interpreted in multiple different ways.
Yeah.
Over and over and over and over again.
But this
and
is every the thing. North Korea is not actually threatening to invade anywhere. It doesn't appear to have any genuine inclinations in that direction. It couldn't if it wanted to.
It could. What do you mean? Of course it could.
Who's it going to invade? South Korea or China are its options.
Well, I mean, it's threatened to turn Japan into a smoldering pile of ashes or something.
Lake of fire, something like that.
You could claim that is a threat, and they do have the means to do it. Now, he knows if he did it, he'd be obliterated. But then again, that assumes he's a rational actor, and nobody, you know, we don't have intelligence enough in the country to know, you know, the CIA, the NSA, MI6, nobody really, so we think, have people on the ground actually spying for us because it's so hard to penetrate. We don't know if he's a rational actor. I mean, It's difficult to know how he would react.
Is there an argument, Danny, from Japan's point of view, and Japan has every right in the world to be upset by this behaviour. It's not just a massive sort of disrespecting of Japan's sovereign airspace. There is also the risk of accident. I mean, though the sky is a big place, it is not inconceivable that they could hit a passenger aircraft. It's probably not even inconceivable rather they could collect shipping at the other end where it lands. Would Japan be within its rights to say to North Korea one more time, and we're coming down there?
I hope they don't, because that would be World War III. I mean, that's the problem with setting all these red lines. They could just easily cross it, and if you don't back it up with threat, then there's no point in doing red lines anymore.
There's also the point that, as far as I have learned from reading around this, I think that missile intercept technology is still relatively rudimentary, and there's not a huge rate of success. And of course, if you do show your cards by trying to intercept one and end up missing, you end up looking like a bit of a wally.
Yeah, it's dicey. I mean, the US is in its tests shot down, I think, 15 out of 15 tests it's had in shooting down missiles, but it's never been in a wartime scenario. So, I mean, you know, if you do that in a war and you miss, that's a huge propaganda win for the North. And, you know, if you hit it, then it's a big propaganda coup. But it's still tricky. I mean, it's like the most advanced physics you could possibly imagine, shooting down a missile traveling, you know, 1,000 miles an hour.
Okay, well, let's move on slightly now and look at US President Donald Trump, which is always fun. After a relatively quiet week, he's been making up for it in the last 24 hours or so. Earlier today, he reiterated his equivocation about last month's events in Charlottesville, in which an anti-racist protester was murdered. Shortly before Trump signed, in fairness, a resolution condemning white supremacists, he meandered off into a rumination about the, quote, very bad people on the other side also, end quote. Since then, he has also responded to the attempted bombing of a London tube train with his usual barely veiled excitement, claiming that the as yet unidentified perpetrator was known to Scotland Yard, and then he complained about an ESPN reporter being nasty about him. Danny, where do you start, really? The Charlottesville thing, a return to his...
What is he thinking?
The better question is he thinking?
When I saw that, I just... You can't even shake your head anymore. It's like... He must know the reaction that he's going to get. I mean, he's not completely oblivious to the world around him.
I don't know.
So why keep saying it?
I mean, is it possible with that particular one that he's trying to reach back out to the people who've been going on Twitter burning their Make America Great Again caps since he tried to do a deal with the Democrats on Dreamers?
Possibly. And he also knows that we're getting, you know, more fatigue, not just missile fatigue, but fatigue at, you know, he said both sides again. And yet on Twitter today, the collective outrage was noticeably smaller than it was the first time around. So he must maybe think that he's not going to outrage people enough, but he will get back some of these hard right people. That's the only kind of reason I could think of.
I actually think he knows what he's doing, because I don't think he's, you know...
Controversial take.
Yeah. No, because, you know, of course, I disagree with what he said, but, you know, he's got, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but about like 35-40% of approval in America. And as I say, this is enough for him to remain president and even to win an election.
It's enough, but it's plummeting, though. I mean, Ann Coulter now has tweeted, does anybody now not want Trump impeached after he backtracked on the Dreamers Act. So he's losing a lot of these far-right people who are like, why are you reaching out to the Democrats? What are you doing? I mean, but as you say, I mean, he still maintains a certain base of support. It's like 35% or whatever.
It's fascinatingly difficult, though, isn't it, to actually read intent into any of his actions and to try to kind of weed out how much deliberation there is, intention there is, strategy there is behind any given one of the things that he says. I mean, I'm not sure if I, like, there's anyone that I trust to do that accurately. And, you know, there are baseline presumptions about his psychology that you don't even, you know, that we don't know about and that we may never know about that would influence an answer to that. I just don't think you can ever tell whether a given thing that he's saying at a given time is part of a medium-term, long-term, or short-term strategy, or not part of any strategy at all.
I think he just gets incredibly excited about things. I think things just sort of
flicker, is the connecting.
Yeah, just flicker factor across his consciousness, and he gets all of a sudden very wound up about it. Danny, again speaking on behalf of your entire country and taking full responsibility for your president, especially, you know, his bizarre outburst today about the attempted bombing of a tube train at Parsons
Green. Well, it's not bizarre. It fits right into his whole narrative of bad people in foreign lands.
Except what he's saying is idiotic. That, you know, he's claiming nobody actually knows who did this, and it's not a thing we should be glib about. It clearly could have been a great deal worse if the device had detonated properly. But, you know, he is broadcasting to the world that this is somebody who Scotland Yard was aware of.
Yeah, of course.
And he's got no idea who it is.
No, Scotland Yard doesn't even, well, maybe they have some ideas, but certainly Trump doesn't know. I mean, it could be some far-right white guy who was, you know, had a vendetta against the TFL. I mean, nobody knows what the hell this was. And yet he, but again, it fits into his narrative of scary person, a scary thing, and far away land. This is why we need to build a big wall.
Does it fit into his pattern of just him understanding there's almost no, there's no punishment for his outburst? I'm reminded of the time in which he kicked off massively about a terror attack in the Philippines, which turned out to be the attempted robbery of a casino.
Indeed, yeah.
But again, this didn't appear to cost him at all.
No. I mean, how would it cost him? I mean, the people who are his base don't know what really happened anyway. I mean, they're not reading, you know, the factual news. And, you know, so it just kind of, it's just another lie in the many, 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 many lies since we've had since January.
I think there's so many of them. It's just difficult to tell what impact any given one of them has. And as a consequence, difficult for people to understand what to punish him for and not.
I mean, for instance, he keeps making the argument that America is the highest tax nation in the world, which is empirically one of the lowest in the developed world. I mean, it's literally polar opposite of what he's saying. And yet people, I guess, intuitively feel in America that they're taxed a lot, so they think they are, and they'll never check, you know, the actual data to back it up. So there it is. It's just something that exists.
It's such enormous work to check data in this day and age. It can take seconds. Yeah. Fernando, one of the things that Trump tweeted today, presumably before John Kelly finally wrestled his phone off him, was the internet, this is Trump talking about loser terrorists, he said the internet is their main recruitment tool which we must cut off and use better. Does that mean anything at all?
It's a joke. It sounds like a joke, because that can very quickly be applied to himself in some ways. I mean, even his usage of that website, for me, is a joke.
I mean, I it's one of those things that makes me wonder if he actually understands what the internet is.
Not a lot of people do understand what the... I mean, a lot of people think you could just stop the internet. I mean, look at any dictatorship. Turkey thinks they could sometimes just stop the internet, but you know, you can never stop it because it's not a centralized thing. I mean, it's distributed.
It is really
weird. That's my
weird.
Science take on this.
I'm not sure.
Have we clarified anything here, or have we just described chaos?
I am just reading the sentence with my, you know, former editor and sub-editor's hat on. You just think if you were editing copy, which included a phrase like "the internet is their main recruitment tool, which we must cut off and use better!" Exclamation mark.
Well, you should look at the New York. I mean, the New Yorker does videos every week of they kind of sub-edit Donald Trump speeches and tweets and everything. It's a bit pretentious, but it's kind of funny because they're just so horribly wrong.
I would be sending an extremely brisk email to that contributor. We are going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, Daniel Giacopelli, Henry Rhys Sheridan, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Do stay tuned.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. for an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into The Menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine, and he baked me a potato, and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monocle's program on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers, and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. Vegetables, sorry, I said to say carrots, but I love carrots, so I meant vegetables in general.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Henry Reece Sheridan, Daniel Giacopelli, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Now, there is arguably no human right more precious than the right to speak freely. Without it, none of the other human rights are terrifically operable. A shame, then, that the arguments around free speech tend to be dominated, especially in the social media sphere, by people who are the best imaginable arguments against it. At the University of California, Berkeley, a huge and expensive security operation has been necessary to permit an address by Ben Shapiro, a conservative commentator. Fernando, this does seem to have gone off quietly, bar a few arrests. In a lovely Baroque little detail, I noticed that UC Berkeley is offering counselling to anybody who's been unduly stressed by this commotion. Ben Shapiro, probably not somebody with whom I would agree about many things, but still, he you know, if he is invited to speak at a distinguished university or indeed UC Berkeley, he's perfectly entitled to go there and talk, isn't he?
I agree, actually. And to be honest, I did read a little bit about Ben Shapiro. I was not the main expert on him. I disagree with him, I think, in most of the topics. But, you know, first of all, I don't think he's like a neo-Nazi or something. He's not that bad, because I do think freedom of speech, there are certain limits that you have to obey. Not that many, you know, only if it's really extreme. But I don't think that's the case of Ben Shapiro. And I think it's quite stupid to do a violent protest against him. I think there are better ways to protest. I'm not saying that you shouldn't show your disagreement against Ben or anybody else. But I think the way it is being handled by some of the students, I don't think that was correct.
Henry, is there a symbiotic relationship, as this is a massively leading question from me, because frankly I suspect there is, between right-wing blowhards and left-wing protesters? This is basically two bunches of people who basically quite enjoy a good tear-up, isn't it?
I think there is a symbiotic relationship, yes, in the strictly kind of biological sense of that term. Like, I don't think the organisms would exist without the nutrients provided by the other. I don't think that either of them would like to admit that. But this kind of ties into a question that I would like to ask Danny.
Here we go.
Which is that, I may be wrong here, but it strikes me that in comparison, kind of when you look at all the kind of Western countries together, America seems to go through cycles of culture wars in which both sides take their positions to more extreme ends of the spectrum than they are taken in other Western countries, kind of every 20 years or so, or 30 years or so. Is there anything about American culture in particular, from your perspective, is there any explanation you can come up with as to why that is? And do you think that's an accurate reading?
It is a place of extremes. I mean, you have me there. I mean, America just seems to me like a cast of colorful characters, and you know, everybody's bizarre, and we have the richest people in the world and some of the poorest people. I mean, it's like the disparities are huge. It's like, you know, the former Soviet Empire. It's like some kind of like War and Peace novel. But I think it's just because it's on a bigger scale than the UK. If you stretch the UK out, it probably would be the same.
Don't you think there's also a kind of performative element to the expression of political grievance on both sides, which lead these debates to be played out in very public, demonstrative ways? On publicly visible stages like universities, in streets. From my perspective too, particularly when so much of this kind of debate is now hosted on social media, there is an undeniable narcissism on both sides, I think.
Massively.
Where, you know, both sides, it strikes me, want to feel... They want almost to, like they're part of a historical moment.
Exactly. They want to feel like they're important. They want to feel like they're at the centre of great events. And this prompts, I guess, my own thought on this, which I'll put to you, Danny. And I was thinking about this earlier today because following the attempted bombing at Parsons Green, the usual suspects emerge on social media. And, of course, what they have to say, foolish, ignorant and ill-informed, though it almost always is disseminated and broadcast far and wide by people who disagree with them, who are quite enjoying getting swept up in the outrage. So my question is, if a blowhard provocateur of any stripe is coming to your university campus, isn't the best thing just not to show up? Just ignore them?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when I was back at college, university, I mean, conservative speakers came all the time. They spoke in, like, you know, the big chapel, and everybody went. There was no protests. It was kind of just like a civil affair. You didn't go if you didn't want to. The college Republicans would organize it, or the college Democrats. There was none of this. And Ben Shapiro, yeah, he's conservative, but there were some signs at Berkeley where it said, you know, go home, you white supremacist. He's not a white supremacist at all.
I mean, that reduces
your argument against actual white supremacists.
But if you look at, you know, the events that are being organized at Berkeley, they're clearly bringing speakers, and upcoming ones include Stephen Bannon and include Milo Yiannopoulos, who is somehow still a thing. They're doing it because it's UC Berkeley. They know they'll get a reaction. Whereas what I genuinely don't understand is, if you see a, I'll put this one to you, Fernando. If you see a poster saying speaking this weekend at your university, Milo Yiannopoulos, why not just think he's an idiot? I've got no interest whatsoever in anything he might say. I'm going to do something more interesting with my evening.
Or I have a tip, because I remember when actually I studied law in Brazil for a year and a half, and I went to a talk. He was quite a conservative lawyer in Brazil, quite famous, and I did ask him a question at the end, and I think I won the battle. No, I'm sorry
the
to
evening.
Say. No, because, you know, he was basically saying that, you know, the Constitution of Brazil should use religion, but Brazil is, you know, we don't have an official religion, so
I mean,
it was something like that.
Extremist Fernando Pacheco.
I mean, it was a very
engaging and constructive debate.
It was all very polite.
If there is somebody who shows up who is so atrociously obnoxious, like Milo. I mean, that guy...
His nightmare is walking out in front of an empty room.
And there's nobody being there. Yeah.
And nobody caring that
Fair
he's
enough.
There.
I wonder if the issue, if there's an element here as well, of during periods where genuine, hateful, harmful speech...
Like apartheid.
...is increased.
Yeah.
Well, specifically speech, though. In a period where, you know, speech is actually being used to cause harm... Does it become more difficult for people, or do people become less tolerant of speech that they disagree with in general, and in the fog of war, less able to draw distinctions between speech, which is hate speech, and speech that they simply disagree with? It strikes me that the left, particularly in America, certainly has an issue with that at the moment, has a problem with just being able to make that distinction.
Well, at the risk of curtailing everybody's free speech on this subject, we are going to move on. One of the few high street fixtures as yet unmenaced by the internet is the old-fashioned corner shop, that place you go when you've forgotten to buy milk, or if it's raining and you'd frankly rather dine on instant noodles than walk all the way to the supermarket. This may change if the proprietors of a new app called Bodega have their way. They hope to install ubiquitous unmanned cupboards of comestibles and essentials unlockable by smartphone. Danny, aren't these just vending machines, or am I missing something?
They're vending machines with more household goods, all the stuff you could get at a bodega, basically.
What is a bodega, Danny?
A bodega is what you would call in the UK an off-license. Just like a place where you go, you get
your dishwashing detergent, your alcohol. They can't sell alcohol from these.
Yeah.
How would you provide proof of age?
You have to share a D. Oh, you mean in the vending machine?
Yeah, from the bodega.
Or paracetamol as well. I tried to buy...
You know what, actually, I don't think they
have
Were
you trying
booze.
To buy alcohol and paracetamol?
Yes, I did.
In for fag.
I went to a self-service machine at Waitrose.
Couple DVDs.
Yeah. And they didn't accept. I had to wait like 2 minutes to approve.
I don't think you could buy... And these would be fitted with video cameras that check who you are and automatically kind of like get your credit card. I just think...
But we haven't mentioned the controversy here.
The controversy is that it would
controversy.
Put,
yeah.
is Which, that it would put the actual bodegas out of business.
Would it
well,
really?
More than that, people have said that it's kind of sacrilegious to apply the bodega label to these automated kiosks.
Sure, because these are loved. I mean, they really in New York City. I mean, your local bodega is where you go to talk to your friend who runs it. You get your stuff, yeah, and you leave.
And they're also considered to be long.
No, honestly, it's not the same as the UK.
Danny, but you're talking. You come from a country where people in shops speak to each other. Which Australians and British people regard as somewhat eccentric.
Well, I mean, I think it definitely would put a lot of bodegas. I mean, you know, there's an off-license near me that went out of business just because a big old fancy supermarket opened up right next door.
But isn't this, I mean, this happens a lot. You get people who say that, you know, obviously they would like their local high street to be full of, you know, independent businesses, etc. And then you ask them, where do you actually go and spend money? And they say, well, yeah, the big supermarket, obviously. Isn't this one of those
New York's different. New York's different. People go to their local bodega. They really
I'm aware.
You can get a bacon, egg, and cheese bagel at a bodega. Anything you want.
I have in my time gotten bacon, egg, and cheese bagels at bodegas. And try saying that five times quickly.
I also actually support the local shops. I actually deliberately don't buy a magazine sometimes in big shops because I know I can buy in Chewton Street with 3G.
There was a really funny tweet about this today. It said by this actor, same origin story for every tech startup. I went into a store, saw someone with a job and thought, what if that person didn't have a job? Which is pretty true for most startups these days.
Very quickly, would we use bodega if it becomes a thing?
I probably would. I'm a sucker for convenience, I have to say. I'm not very sentimental.
And I'm not very sentimental, but I am a massive technophobe.
I mean, listen, Uber...
It could go one way or the
Uber
other.
Uber puts the black cabs out of business too, and I generally don't feel any...
I wouldn't, only
that.
If it's raining heavily and I need a biscuit
but
or
I wouldn't,
something.
But I would not use bodega.
So raining heavily and need a biscuit, that would be a very, very niche bodega.
It can happen.
Is it raining heavily? Do you need a biscuit? Try bodega. Just finally, before we go, it says here that the Emmys are going to be distributed on Sunday. Fernando, these are the ones, as I understand it, for television?
Yes, and they are becoming glamorous by the year. It's true because, you know...
I will never know. I'm happy to take your word.
They used to be the poor cousin of the Oscars. I mean, they still are poorer compared to the Oscars. But, you know, TV is becoming such a big thing, so
this
exciting. When you look at the best drama series, for the first time you have like 5 out of the 7 nominees. They are like first seasons. So it feels quite fresh this year.
Fernando, I want to know about your glamorometer. How do you evaluate the glamour of a given award ceremony?
From 0 to 10?
Can we get one? Can we literally get a Fernando's glamorometer
in the
studio?
Physical
the
device.
Emmys for me...
It goes from Henry to Danny.
Or we could at least have it on the website.
The Emmys are 6 out of 10 at the moment, which is all right. It's more than five.
How have they become more glamorous?
Because TV is more exciting. A lot of Hollywood actors, in fact, are going on TV. And I think probably if you're going to use a nice dress or a nice suit, you think more now to go to the Emmys.
How could they kick it up to 7 if they're at 6 now?
Well, I think this year it's becoming a 7.
It's nudging 7.
Yes, it's nudging 7.
You heard it here first. Well, I think that's an exclusive.
More cowbell.
Thanks to Handmaid's Tale, Stranger Things, and many other nice series.
There is the verdict on the Emmys, nudging 7. They can put that on the posters. Nudging 7, yes. Monocle 24. That brings us to the end of today's show. Actually, that'd be a good name for a jazz band as well. Danny, Fernando, and Henry, thanks for joining us here at Midori House. The show was produced by Danny, researched by Fernando and Sophia Armadi. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. I'm back with more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.